Session number 7266, reel 9.
General Lloyd, reel 9. I think you were telling me what happened to you after General Peter was sent off.
Yes, we got to Hexham, didn't we? And it's a bit pretentious to talk about the 12th Division at this stage. All I can say is what was left of 12th Division was concentrated at Hexham. General Peter was posted to a new job almost as soon as we got to Hexham. Although I can remember his attending a party given by the mayor of Hexham. And he then went away. Various brigadiers were called in to command the division for a day or two, but it was quite soon that I found myself as the senior remaining officer in the rank of major, let me tell you, which I was by then, at divisional headquarters. And I was left to do the formal disbanding of the 12th Division. And in fact, we held a little midnight ceremony on the day in which the division was due to be disbanded by War Office order. And we all paraded round the flagstaff. We had a crate of beer at the bottom of the flagstaff. We hauled down the 12th Divisional pennant and we rolled it up. And the next day we sent it off to General Peter as his new address. And the division was then disbanded. And it was during that period, and I think I have just mentioned this to you, that we suddenly realized that we still had the 12th Division code book, which we had rescued from the maniac who had it under control and whom we brought back to the UK. So we took it to Northern Command at York and handed it in. And two things occur to me about that. The first was, and probably the most important part, was that this divisional code had been recorded as lost. And at that point in time, this would have been round about, somewhere in July, I suppose, mid-July. This code had been reported lost. They were just about to reissue a new code to all divisions when this one of ours turned up at Northern Command headquarters and was received with great sighs of relief all round. It was a very humorous occasion because when we got into the headquarters, nobody challenged us because we had this book with us and everybody was very impressed. We got into the G1's office and I had a staff captain with me who'd come to York with me for the ride. And we were suddenly held up at pistol point in the G1's office because they realized that nobody had asked us for identity, and we were thought to be saboteurs who gate-crashed the headquarters. It really was an absurd time, that was, you know.
Sounds like a comic opera.
It was a sort of comic opera time. It really was. Anyway, that's the literal truth of what happened to the code book of the 12th Division.
You say you've taken it from the maniac. This was presumably someone who cracked under the strain.
This was the intelligence officer, actually. And I've forgotten his name, the intelligence officer, he went all through the so-called Battle of France with this code book linked to a steel strap round his waist with lock and key. And he was obviously a pretty immature character because he was so overwhelmed by what had happened to us and the responsibility that he had for this code book. As I've said, he literally went round the bin. And we had a very good divisional medical officer who, incidentally, was a chap called Fox, who before the war had been editor of The Lancet. And this intelligence officer was brought back to UK under the care of Captain Fox and was given sedatives all the way until we got back to Hexham, where he was hospitalised.
Do you know what happened to him eventually? Was he treated and then put back into the army?
No, I don't know. I have no knowledge of what happened to him afterwards. None at all. And we also, strangely enough, had a DDoS, a deputy assistant director of ordnance services. Every division had one, and he'd been arrested at this place, Guy Fontaine, which I've told you about. And to cut a long story short, he turned out to be a kleptomaniac. We found him with there'd been a lot of thefts from the officers of divisional headquarters. Things like oil compasses, binoculars, pistols of various sorts, and so on. And the security police were put onto it, and they tracked it down to him. And he was found to have a fairly large steel trunk, literally full of the spoils of of his operations. And he was arrested, and before he could be court-martialed, the phony war was broken and we started to move forward and back and so on. And he went through the whole thing. It's a very strange thing. That's two of them. He went through the whole thing under close arrest. Most extraordinary thing.
Was he an effective officer in his military role?
Well, he didn't have anything to do, as a matter of fact. There was really no function for a DDoS. You know, it was one of those things that was going to develop as the division built up to a fully operational division. But during our operations, such as they were, you know, there was nothing for a DDoS to do. He was simply a supernumerary officer, really, and under close arrest for the whole of the movement. I do know what happened to him. You asked me what happened to the intelligence officer, which I can't tell you, but this DDoS chap was, in fact, court-martialed at Fenwick Barracks while we were up there, but he was found unfit to plead and he was outed on medical grounds in the end.
Sounds like he had an extreme case of the quartermaster's jackdaw disease.
That's right. That's right. Well, after, perhaps you'd like to know what happened to me.
Yes.
Immediately after Hexham, and then perhaps we could pack this up for today, if that'd be all right. Well, I was given a very strange posting. I remained at Hexham after the division had been disbanded, as far as I remember, for about a week. And then I received posting orders to be staff officer, Coast Artillery, to the There was, in fact, a post in those days, a Major General commanding Coast Artillery, and I was posted to Portsmouth, which was where his headquarters was. For the life of me, his name escapes me, but I'll try and think about that, and I'll give you his name later on. He was, in fact, a fairly well-known officer. However, this job, which I only held for about a month, because I was then posted in a hurry to the Canadian Army, but this post was very interesting. It was, in general, the idea was to put the coastal defences and the anti-aircraft defences in a posture to resist invasion. And during the month that I did this job, I was oscillating along the south coast, roughly from the Portsmouth area to Dover and round to Chatham. The very first thing we discovered were that although Portsmouth was very extensively defended by anti-aircraft artillery, heavy ACAC, no one had given them any ground role in a defensive role, anti-invasion. And one of the first jobs to do was to go round and make sure that all of these guns could be depressed by the same amount, by the right amount, and able to zero in on ground targets, right on the shore, you know, and also in land. And it's a strange thing that no thought had been given to this at all. We had to, among other things, we had to get range tables prepared, because this was, of course, an entirely new role for anti-aircraft artillery, and to map the area, prepare defensive maps, zones of fire, and everything that is involved in an anti-invasion role. I found this period, as a gunner, very, very fascinating indeed. It was absolutely thrilling.
So the idea was to make anti-tank, anti-aircraft weapons into anti-tank weapons.
And that's right.
Presumably also to use them against landing craft.
That's right. Landing craft and anti-tank. And, of course, at that time, as you probably know, they were impeding the beaches, you know, and in the various ways, barbed wire, obstacles, and then, of course, round to the southeastern parts, these flame protection devices that they had, and well, yes, not and. I can't think of anything else to say about that, unless you want to ask me a question. It was extremely interesting. I can tell you also what we discovered at Dover, which was very interesting, but I'll pause just for a moment.
Yes, one thing that does occur to me is whether at that time, in making these plans, the main threat was considered to be the seizure of a port or an attempt to put a force over a beach.
All the thinking in those days was that they would seize, the Germans would cease to seize, would attempt to seize a port. That was all the thinking. I don't think, mind you, all the beaches were zeroed in, though, so that, come to think of it, of course, they must have had that idea. And
but the concentration, presumably, was on...
was on the ports. That's where the main concentration was. But, of course, that's where the guns were also.
And was there a notion that the main attack would come by air, because I know that at one time it was felt that if the enemy did attempt to make an invasion attempt, they would seize selected ports and landing places by parachute attack and then bring in seaborne forces.
Well, so far as the coastal defences were, and this, don't forget, this was staff officer, coast artillery. As far as the coast artillery was concerned, the main concern was with the ports, and secondly with the beaches. Now, subsequently, I know that the German general staff had planned to drop parachutists all along the high ground, the South Downs, the North Downs, and so on. But we knew nothing about that at that time, and that didn't come within the ambit of a coastal artillery commander. Now, coming along to Dover, one of the interesting things about that, we had the same problem with the Dover defences, but one of the interesting things of that was that I'm, I suppose, one of the few officers who ever saw Big Bertha fire from Cap Greenay and actually saw some of her shells land on the Dover cliffs. It was a very, very interesting experience. We had an enormous 18-inch gun mounted on a railway track, at Dover. At least it could run into Dover. And they used to run it into Dover and fire every now and again. And this was a Polish armoured train. The armoured train was entirely staffed by Polish soldiers. I think because we in the British Army had no knowledge of, no recent knowledge at any rate. I believe in the Boer War they had armoured trains and guns on trains. But we had no experience of big guns on trains, but the Polish Army did.
It seems to me that the idea of super heavy artillery is really rather alien to the British.
Oh, completely alien. Subsequently, I learnt that, this was far later on in the war, I learnt that this particular big gun on this particular train was one of those guns that was suddenly remembered by Winston Churchill, do you remember, from the days when he had been Chief of Naval, First Lord of the Admiralty, in World War I? And he, when he got into office as Prime Minister in World War II, he remembered these heavy guns. And it was one of those that was mounted on this armoured train. Whether or not we had any other armoured trains in the same way, I don't know. But certainly there was this one that used to run in and out of Dover. They used to run it out at night, run it out early in the morning, run it back at night, lob a few shells over to the other side, and then bring it out again.
What were they trying to hit when they were firing across the channel?
Oh, I think nothing in particular.
So it was random harassing fire?
Yes, you could call it random harassing fire. It was really a morale booster, which was very effective, actually. It was most I'd never seen, of course, one of these things fire, and it was most impressive. They used to run back about, every time it was fired, used to run back along the line about 30 yards, gathering up the recoil as she went,
When you saw Big Bertha firing, what did you see? Did you see just the flash?
Yes, through binoculars, we used to stare at the other side through binoculars, and you could see a flash, and then it would take several minutes before the shell arrived, and it would usually burst on the cliffs. I don't think they ever... Oh, yes, they did land on Dover once or twice, come to think of it. But, of course, Dover also got bombed, which was very confusing. It was quite exciting down there. At that particular period. In fact, it was damn dangerous.
Presumably there must have been quite a lot of German air activity over.
Oh, there was. That was the time, do you remember, when they bombed all those hotels on the seafront and so on. And also along at, where was it, Hastings, wasn't it? They took out...
I think they were trying to bomb out the radar stations without fully realising what they were.
Yes, that is true. That is true.
How did you find your anti-aircraft gunners took to the idea of firing on ground targets?
It was fighting against operation, against intense opposition all the time. It was rather like, of course, as we subsequently knew, what happened at Singapore. There, all the guns were mounted to fire out to sea, and nobody had ever thought of anybody invading by land and coming up down the peninsula and onto Singapore. So they literally couldn't train the guns round. It was just the same with our AC-AT gunners.
Came from the gunners themselves, did it? The resistance.
Well, hell of a job. Not made very easy by the fact, of course, that they were under different command. You see, they were all under AC-AT command, and our job was a job of persuasion, aided where we could by a sort of half-baked command system, which made us... I remember we had to go through district headquarters and then headquarters Southeastern Command, and then from there to AC-AT Command, and of course old Pyle was a very difficult customer. And it all boiled down in the end to the gentle art of persuasion.
Did you get any support from headquarters, Home Defence Forces?
Very little. Although, as I said at the beginning of this little excerpt, the orders to us were quite definite that that's what we were to do, to go round and coordinate this method of defence. But, of course, to these gunners, this was a secondary role. They were, after all, firing every night, every day, every night, on their
primary target.
Primary AC-AT role. So it's easy to criticise, but it's easily understood, their attitude. Thank God they never had to fire in this particular, in the anti-invasion role.
Did you think at the time that an invasion was likely or imminent?
Well, that was the thinking at the time. This, you see, was... by then it was work going into midsummer. And, of course, the threat of invasion didn't really cease, did it, until, late in September, when there was the sort of final air battle that really decided it. But by that time, of course, I had been posted from that job into the Canadian.
Did you think it was realistic at the time? Did you think the Germans would have a chance of getting ashore?
I think generally we were of the opinion that they would have a chance. They would have a shot, I mean, not a chance, a shot. They would have a shot at it. And there were rumours about... We saw the RAF going over, of course, every day, bombing the Channel ports.
Bombing the invasion barges.
The invasion barges. And the knowledge of the existence of those was pretty widespread. We all knew about it, and we really... I think I could say that we all thought they would have a try, but we were also equally certain that that we would defeat it. One of the interesting ideas which was being bandied about at that time was... everybody, of course, was saying that, well, the Navy is still in existence and we'll see this off. And one of the ideas that was bandied about was that a monitor or a battleship or two, old ones.
Expendable ones.
Yes, expendable ones, would be sailed round and grounded and used as a land fort.
Inshore battery.
Inshore battery. Interesting, isn't it? That was a pretty well, you know, a pretty popular belief at the time.
And how are they going to explain their role to the crew of this particular expendable?
God knows. God knows. Remember, this is a soldier speaking, not a sailor. I think the sailor would have viewed this with a considerable horror.
Sailors generally have a great horror of being grounded.
Oh, rather. But that was what the soldiers were talking about, you know. Oh, we used to use an old battleship, you see, and there we are. The grounding, of course, was so that it shouldn't be sunk during operations. It should have a secure base.
Very comforting.
Very comforting. Well, I think that's about all.